Hello, I'm Patricia Camilleri. Welcome to today's program in this series entitled The Artifact. In these programs, I shall be speaking to some of Malta's most important archaeologists about archaeology in general and about the many fascinating projects that are in progress or planned for the future. My guest today is Dr. Reuben Griemer. Dr. Griemer gained his BA in archaeology and history from the University of Malta. This was followed by a master's in archaeology from the University of Reading in UK. And recently, Dr. Griemer was Commonwealth Scholar at UCL's Institute of Archaeology in London, from where he gained his PhD in archaeology, with the subject of the landscape context of Malta's megalithic monuments. He is now senior curator of the World Heritage Sites that are managed by Heritage Malta. Welcome, Dr. Griemer. Of course, as with many of my other guests that I've had the pleasure of interviewing, we could speak about many aspects of archaeology with you, and it's certainly a pleasure to have you here today. But today we've decided to concentrate on Malta's World Heritage Sites, at least, as we said, those managed by Heritage Malta, because I think there are many things that our listeners will be interested to know about the World Heritage Sites in general, about Malta, etc. So perhaps we could start off by looking at what it means to be a World Heritage Site. What is a World Heritage Site? And look a bit at the local and the global and then perhaps the local context.
Great, yes, certainly. Well, the idea of World Heritage is a UNESCO instrument. It's the subject of a UNESCO convention, which was created in 1972. Of course, before that, there were several years while the idea was developing. And sites started being inscribed in the late 70s on the so-called UNESCO World Heritage List. Now, to get inscribed on this list and get recognized as World Heritage, you need to fulfill a number of criteria, which are defined in the convention itself. And the basic idea is that sites which are of outstanding universal significance to mankind as a whole should be preserved on behalf of the global community. So they not only interest the country in which they happen to be located, but they're of interest to humanity at large, and even to present and to future generations. And therefore, when a country which is party to the convention chooses to nominate a site for inscription on the World Heritage List, effectively it is promising to make a commitment to safeguard that site on behalf of the community and for the community, that is, the global community. And the list has grown and grown. At present, there are over 800 sites inscribed on this list. And one interesting trend, which has been very noticeable in the last few years, is towards redefining outstanding universal significance. In the early days of the convention, there was a very Eurocentric tendency in the convention's management and then the sort of sites which were getting inscribed.
Mostly they would have been perhaps monumental sites.
Exactly, yes. So there's a strong emphasis on even the development of civilization as we understand it in the West. So a strong bias towards European sites where you'd get all your classical Greek monuments and wonderful Renaissance and Baroque monuments and cities, with a rather lower representation of other cultures worldwide. So it's only in the past 10 years or so that there's been a very concrete effort to redress the balance and to aim for a more representative list. There are whole documents and agreements designed specifically to define a strategy to make the list more representative of the global diversity that you have in cultures. And this is very much at the forefront of debates at present.
Mm. The ones that come to mind, I mean, if we'd like to mention some of the sort of the earliest the earliest inscription on this list would, outside Europe, I suppose, Taj Mahal.
Yes, that would be one of the more classic, if you like, the more immediately recognizable. Its outstanding universal value is beyond debate. More recently, sites which in some cases are not even buildings, for instance, that's another evolution that we've seen in the past 15 years or so. In the original convention, the convention contemplates natural sites or cultural sites or possibly mixed properties. But one idea which has come to the fore more recently is the whole notion of cultural landscapes, where the cultural and the natural are quite inseparable. So from the point of view of a naturalist and a biologist, a site which may not be extraordinarily exciting may, and also which from the point of view of an archaeologist in the strict sense, may not be the most obvious site to inscribe, may, if you take into account the interaction between the cultural and the natural, suddenly become very special and very interesting. Mm-hmm. And of course, many of these cultural landscapes are of outstanding importance on both grounds, of course, both natural and cultural.
So they're taking a more sort of holistic
yes.
View of what it means to be culturally and environmentally interesting.
It's
seeing the workings of the two.
Exactly, looking at sustainable practices by pre-industrialized societies, for instance, and their whole belief systems. Like one example, of course, is Ayers Rock in Australia, which is a site of tremendous importance for Aboriginal communities.
Now, no longer there. Called Ayers Rock, I understand. I can't remember the original name.
Yes, and I'm struggling to right
Doesn't
now.
Doesn't matter.
And it will come to me at the end of the program.
Other examples of sort of landscapes? Other examples that come to mind of this new approach that?
Well, it's becoming quite widespread. So even archaeological monuments, which may in the past have got inscribed in their own right as purely a cultural site, are now getting presented as part of the larger landscape. And this could range from rock art sites, where, of course, the relationship with the landscape is
fundamental,
essential to their very meaning.
You mentioned before the idea that we're talking about places of world importance, and yet they are always obviously local. This is something
Absolutely,
that has to
yes.
be an idea that has to be married together. The idea of the global and the
indeed, very much so. Looking at the convention and the text of the convention, the 1972 convention, there's a very strong accent on outstanding universal value. Okay, it's outstanding significance for humanity as a whole. So the thinking is very much on a global level. Now, part of the critique and the rethinking that we've had in these past 30 years, especially in the more recent part of that, is that very often value is very culture-specific and it's very embedded in local value systems. So there's a tension, if you like, here between global frames of reference and local frames of reference. And the tendency now is to look very much at, to underline the importance of diversity and also to create a space so that even where value is culture specific, to use the instruments of the convention to share that culturally specific frame of value and reference, and to share those elements of it which may be of global interest and relevance. Mm. So given that the global communities have changed, we live in a shrinking world, of course, which has gone through whole sea changes, even with developments like the internet and mass communication. So our whole way of looking at other cultures has developed, and inevitably our value systems have developed with that. So our whole way of looking at other cultures has gone through a transformation. And the convention is working hard on continuing to represent that faithfully. Mm. So it's become quite a dynamic.
Yeah, I was going to say that's an interesting thing, because often one feels that these conventions are sometimes written in stone, but of course that they aren't, and they are they grow, and they must grow really with the developments within. And reflect developments within society.
Absolutely, absolutely.
If you don't do that, also direct society's thinking a little bit as well. I mean, it must be a two-way.
Absolutely, two-way and thing. And this is back to global and local. It would be quite sterile if getting inscribed on the convention simply meant this global recognition, without it somehow being ploughed back into what people are doing at a local level, and that. Nor is it the intention for the convention to be used as an authoritarian instrument, a policing instrument, where if you step out of line, the instruments of the convention will be brought to bear by the world community to correct any local deficiencies. Of course, in extreme cases, there are mechanisms in the convention where measures can be taken if a site is not being cared for. And the commitments made by the state party are not being honoured. But that is...
That's part of the signing up to it, really.
Absolutely.
Mean, if you're not prepared for that kind of overseeing, then obviously you don't sign up to the...
Totally. But those are really extreme scenarios.
Sure.
By and large, the preference is to proceed by consensus and also to be an instrument of enablement rather than a policing instrument. So a lot of resources are put into, for instance, helping developing countries to create management plans for these sites. Given the lack of resources, of course, that's where the limited resources available to the World Heritage Fund, that is where they are best directed. Likewise, there is a reporting system, which includes periodic reporting, which is happening on a seven-year cycle now, in which every country must produce reports about the state of each inscribed site. And that report is also designed to encourage state parties and site managers to spot areas of weakness and to work on them. So it's not an exam, if you like, which you pass or fail, and which you get sanctioned for,
but rather than
it's
to hinder
pretty
or,
much an autocritical exercise.
Well, before we move on to talk about sort of Malta's contribution to the list, I'd just like to remind listeners who might only have just joined us that this is The Artifact, and I'm Patricia Camilleri, talking to Dr. Ruben Grima, who is Senior Curator of the World Heritage Sites managed by Heritage Malta. So now to Malta. What does Malta offer? We know that two or three or even four of our sites are inscribed on the list. Which are they?
Well, in a nutshell, you could say that as a country, Malta has perhaps the highest density of World Heritage Sites per square kilometre on this little archipelago, because we have three inscriptions. Originally, when first inscribed in 1980, we had the city of Valletta, the Saflina Hypogeum, and the Gigantea temples. In 1992, the inscription of the Gigantea temples was extended to include six of the megalithic temples of Malta, which are now inscribed as a series. So they still count as one World Heritage Site.
As a block.
But it's exactly, yes. So a block of six discrete sites. One on Gozo, the original inscription of Gigantea, and five other sites on Malta, which are Tarshin, Tahajrat, Skorba, Hajar Im, and the Mnaidra.
I see. And which of these are under your own responsibility?
Well, Heritage Malta manages
Heritage Malta.
Two of these three inscriptions. So it does not manage Valletta, but it manages the other two inscriptions, which are the Saflina Hypogeum and the megalithic temples of Malta. All of which are prehistoric sites. Both the Hypogeum and the megalithic temples are all in use at the same time. They all date from the late Neolithic. That's the last stage of the Neolithic in Malta. So roughly from the middle of the 4th millennium BC to the middle of the 3rd millennium BC.
And what is the responsibility that we have then towards these monuments? What must be special, if anything, about our treatment of them vis-a-vis the having signed the convention?
I mean, yes.
Do we have extra responsibilities, or would we be doing the same kind of responsibilities anyway? Would we be following up on the same things anyway?
Well, strictly speaking, we should have been doing the same things anyway, though that's an imaginary scenario. Strictly speaking, what the convention obliges you to do is, and what you commit to do when you sign up to the convention, is simply best practice in the field. So I would not expect a major difference in the sort of thing one would aspire to do, but the fact that the sites are inscribed on the list means, of course, that there is much more visibility of these, much more possibility of support for interventions on the site, which could be both technical and financial, even from sources other than the World Heritage Fund, because, as I said earlier, those resources are directed primarily towards developing countries. But the fact that we are inscribed on the list does have a bearing even when applying for European Union funds, as we have, and we are in fact spending considerable European Union funds at present on the management of and conservation of a number of these sites. Mm-hmm. So
do you have I presume you have a sort of ongoing plan, project that you work on with a sort of wish list of things that you would like to be able to do at the sites or with the sites, which obviously then has to be balanced with the financial possibilities.
Certainly, yes. So we do have a work program, and we could pick it up from what we see as our core function, and that is, the smallest possible nutshell, it is to secure the maximum possible enjoyment of these sites. Now, that, of course, means not only enjoying them today, but also permitting future generations and different audiences around the world to enjoy them. So that immediately brings in the whole issue of conservation and sustainability. So to ensure the greatest possible amount of enjoyment of these sites, we have to find ways of enjoying these sites which are sustainable. So there has to be a balance between enjoyment and conservation. And our mission is very much to juggle those two sides of the coin and to achieve the optimal balance between the two. Now, in practice, that means putting into place a conservation strategy that will ensure that the lifetime of these sites is extended, ideally indefinitely. Mm-hmm. And practical examples of that, which are happening at present, are, for example, the environmental monitoring that is going on at a number of these sites, especially at Hajar Eem and Imnaidra, where we have an intensive program of environmental monitoring going on at present, with the express aim of looking at the relationship between environmental conditions and deterioration of these sites. Mm-hmm. Because, as you know, one of the principal components, the principal types of stone used in these buildings, which is Globigerina limestone, is extremely vulnerable to changes in temperature and humidity. And having been exposed for such a long period of time, and in some cases having been sealed underground until 1839 and 1840 in the case of Hajar Eem and Imnaidra, in the past 150 years, the deterioration has been considerable. And unless interventions are put into place to retard this and slow down this deterioration, we will progressively lose these sites. Mm. And the monitoring that's going on will feed directly into another exercise which is planned, which is the installation of a protective shelter over these two sites.
Much discussed cover.
Indeed, indeed. And again, we could speak about that briefly. It's not an easy issue and has not been an easy decision to take, because of course we'd all rather see these sites without any sort of cover or other intrusion. The best metaphor for it is perhaps looking at crutches or wearing a brace, for example. It's not something which makes us look prettier, but if it's necessary for our long-term well-being, we lump it for as long as it's necessary. And in fact, these shelters are intended as an interim solution. They're just there to buy time for the site for the next 25 to 30 years while research continues on trying to identify ways of stabilizing the site which would be less visually intrusive. But at present, there is no tried and tested method which can be used to intervene directly on the original material on these sites, which conservators are happy and comfortable with. Mm-hmm. Sure. And of course, once you intervene, although best practice, the principle of best practice is that everything is reversible, in practice, all conservators know that most interventions are never 100% reversible.
Whereas removing the cover is.
Well, yes, the cover is relatively simple.
I think on the whole, there's been a lot of open discussion about that and seminars and things. The people I speak to who are, you know, most of them quite purist in their approach to these things, I think they've taken on board that idea on the whole. I think I've heard very little, okay, people grumble, they say, oh, well, you know, what a pity. Mm-hmm. But I think they do understand that it is going to be a temporary thing, hopefully, and that there's a jolly good reason for doing it. Mm-hmm. Like people complain as well about only 10 people at a time going into hypogeum,
yes,
which is another of the much discussed things.
But
on the whole,
people complain in a very informed way. Well, I'm glad you're saying that, because we did try to invest a lot of energy in sharing the process which led us to that decision. And of course, it's not an easy change.
No, of course not.
The sites are sacred and they're central to our identity. They're sites we expect people to feel strongly about. We feel strongly about this, and I, to speak personally, saddened by the fact that we do need a shelter. It's ironic that much of my research is about the landscape context of these sites and the way they relate to their setting. So there's an irony there, I suppose. But on balance, given the choice between enjoying the sites without the intrusion of a shelter and passing those sites on to the next generation in a much reduced state, on the one hand, and on the other hand, living with a shelter and passing on those sites in the present state of conservation, it becomes very easy for me to choose
the
latter.
Choice, make the choice.
And having said all this, the shelters are, of course, designed to look very ephemeral and very transient.
Yes.
They're like Bedouin tents, practically,
in
contrast to the permanence of the megalithic masonry, which is... So it will underline their permanence.
In the short time that we have available, are there future plans for the development of the sites? Are there other things that are playing on your mind that you're thinking of doing with them?
Well, certainly. We had time to say a lot about conservation, but less about presentation of these sites. And a lot is being done in that direction as well. And visitor centres are being planned and developed, both for Hajar Imam and the Mnaidra and for the Tarshan temples. And down the line in the future, we also hope also at the Jigantia temples. I should mention that apart from the European funds which we're using at Hajar Imam and the Mnaidra, we have funding from the Bank of Valletta for the Tarshin project and funding from Vodafone for the Jigantia project. So it's given us a huge amount of enablement in that respect. And for the first time, we have the luxury of being able to try to design the optimal solutions for these sites. And public presentation and accessibility will be a central part of that strategy. we are heavily committed to making these sites more universally accessible to all audiences. So that means both physical, intellectual and economic accessibility. And we want to create a much more interactive and rewarding encounter with this World Heritage, which is meaningful to different audiences. And by interactive, I don't mean it in the narrow sense of just using IT and high-tech solutions, but we also want a hands-on, tactile experience where people can engage with different materials and actually do things and get a sensation of what it's like to mold pottery, for example, or to work stone. So that is very much at the heart of our vision, and that's the way we hope we'll be moving towards.
Direction we're moving in. That's great. Yes. This lovely connection between what's in the museum and the sites as well, the megalithic sites, is something I think that is going to be developed. I'm sure you'll be doing that, because many of the things have been removed from the sites and taken to the museum. So there has to be that link. Sometimes it's sort of a bit broken because of literally because of the distance of the two.
Absolutely.
Anyway, our time's come to an end, as usual, in a hurry. I'd like to thank Dr. Reuben Greemer for being with us today and for talking to us, explaining a little bit about what World Heritage Sites are and something about the Maltese World Heritage Sites. Until next time we meet, this is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.